Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, December 6, 2022. U.S. Capitol Police and Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police, who defended the U.S. Capitol building during the attack, January 6, 2021, some of them with their lives, awarded today congressional gold medals. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying January 6 was a day of horror and heartbreak. It is also a moment of extraordinary heroism, staring down deadly violence and despicable bigotry. U.S. Senate leaders differing on the prospects of reaching a full fiscal year government funding agreement. The Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, still hopeful of getting a deal. Republican leader Mitch McConnell saying no, the sides are too far apart, and the best approach is a short-term funding measure into 2023. Work also continuing on the Defense Authorization Bill, the NDAA, which is the other large bill expected to pass in the lame duck session of Congress. But maybe some disagreements still on what non-defense related bills to attach to it. Some Republican and Democratic senators still trying to piece together a bipartisan immigration reform bill before the Republicans take control of the House in January. We'll talk about that with a Washington Post reporter. And Election Day in Georgia for the U.S. Senate runoff. We'll get the latest from a Hill congressional reporter about what a victory for either Democratic incumbent Raphael Warnock or Republican challenger Herschel Walker means for how the Senate will function going forward. And we start with the presentation of congressional gold medals recognizing the hundreds of law enforcement officers who defended the U.S. Capitol January 6, 2021. Associated Press writes that this comes nearly 2 years after they fought supporters of then-President Donald Trump in a brutal and bloody attack. Ceremony held in the Capitol Rotunda, which, again, is from the AP article, was overrun that day when Donald Trump supporters roamed the halls trying to stop Congress from certifying Joe Biden's election. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi opened today's ceremony.
Gather here exactly 23 months ago, our nation suffered the most staggering assault on democracy since the Civil War. January 6th was a day of horror and heartbreak, yet is also a moment of extraordinary heroism. Staring down deadly violence and despicable bigotry, our law enforcement officers bravely stood in the breach, ensuring that democracy survived on that dark day. So on behalf of the United States Congress and the American people, it is my honor to present the Congressional Gold Medal to the United States Capitol Police, the Metropolitan Police, and every hero of January 6th from every agent that responded that day. May this medal, the highest honor that Congress can bestow, serve as a token of our nation's deepest gratitude and respect. Not as full, but as a token. And in accepting this medal, you bring luster to this award, just as you bring luster to the Congress and the Constitution of the United States.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California. Four congressional gold medals presented today to be placed at U.S. Capitol Police Headquarters, the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C., at the U.S. Capitol Building, and the Smithsonian Institution. When President Biden signed the legislation last year to award the medals, he said the reason for a medal at the Smithsonian was that all visitors to the museum can understand what happened that day. Both the Democratic and Republican leaders of the House and the Senate spoke at today's ceremony. Here is the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy of California.
These brave men and women in uniform stood strong in the line of duty for our country, and we're forever grateful for that. This Congressional Gold Medal commemorates their courage, professionalism, and patriotism. There's no more fitting place to show our gratitude than the Rotunda of the Capitol, a room that is a symbol of a sacred building, a symbol of a great nation, a symbol of freedom and self-government here and around the world. The Capitol Police and DC Police are valued members of this community. But they're also members of another community, the community of law enforcement, the brotherhood of law enforcement. By awarding them the Congressional Gold Medal, we're not only honoring them for protecting our nation and community on January 6th, but we're honoring them for the essential brotherhood as well. To all the law enforcement officers who keep this country safe, thank you. Putting on the badge means putting yourselves in harm's way to protect others, to keep the country safe. These brave men and women are heroes, heroes who protected so many from harm on that day, heroes who live out the code to protect and serve, heroes who do the noble work. Too many people take that for granted. But days like today force us to realize how much we owe that thin blue line.
The House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy at today's U.S. Capitol Rotunda ceremony. More from the Associated Press article. At least 9 people who were at the Capitol that day, January 6, 2021, died during and after the rioting, including a woman who was shot and killed by police as she tried to break into the House chamber, and 3 other Donald Trump supporters who suffered medical emergencies. 2 police officers died by suicide in the days that immediately followed, and a 3rd officer, Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, collapsed and later died after one of the rioters sprayed him with a chemical. Medical examiner determined he died of natural causes. And several months after the attack, the Metropolitan Police announced that 2 more of their officers who had responded to the insurrection had died by suicide. The circumstances that led to their deaths were unknown. That from Associated Press. The leaders of both the U.S. Capitol Police and the D.C. Police speaking today. Tom Manger is the Capitol Police Chief.
I'm honored to accept this Congressional Gold Medal on behalf of the men and women of the United States Capitol Police, who bravely sacrificed their own safety in order to protect the Capitol building, the members of Congress, and our country's legislative processes on January 6, 2021. I also want to thank our law enforcement partners, especially the Metropolitan Police Department, who came to our aid that day. Words cannot adequately express our gratitude for what you did to help our officers by joining in the fight that was taking place. It was a day like... It was a day unlike any other in our nation's history. And for us, it was a day defined by chaos, courage, tragic loss, and resolve. And I especially want to recognize our officers who made the ultimate sacrifice, Officer Brian Sicknick, Officer Howard Liebengood. And I want to recognize also Officer Billy Evans, who was lost in the line of duty on April 2nd, 2021, when he was attacked outside the Capitol by a lone assailant. I cannot thank our officers enough for their courage, for their resolve, in order to help us protect the Capitol and the Congress from such a horrific attack. And on the very next day, these officers went back to work and continued to carry out our mission. I know that Congress appreciates that you all continue to do your job with dedication each and every day.
Tom Manger is the U.S. Capitol Police Chief at today's ceremony. You can find the full video. C-SPAN covered it live at our website at cspan.org. And as Speaker Pelosi mentioned, the Congressional Gold Medal is the highest honor Congress can bestow. This article from CNN, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, has decided to make criminal referrals to the Department of Justice. The panel's chairman, Congressman Benny Thompson, told reporters Tuesday. Thompson, a Mississippi Democrat, said the committee has not narrowed down the universe of individuals who may be referred. Reporters asking about this to another Democratic member of the committee, Pete Aguilar of California.
Chairman Thompson said this morning that the January 6th committee will be issuing some criminal referrals for people active in your investigation. The committee said a short while later that criminal referrals will be a part of the discussion going forward, but there have been no decisions or final decisions on that yet. Can you shed some light on what's going on here, what the holdup is on making these decisions, and where you guys are headed in the coming weeks?
Decision points ahead. The committee continues to meet, meetings upcoming, and decision points to be made. We'll announce anything that we have, likely as a part of our final report. But what the last comment is the comment that stands, that we haven't finalized any decisions yet. Our options are on the table. Referrals to outside agencies are possible. And as soon as the committee finishes our work, we look forward to sharing the results.
And what's the holdup in making a final decision?
Still having conversations, still looking at language. Committee members are meeting almost daily now. We're editing pieces of the report as well. There's chapters that we have read, there's chapters that we have edited, and information that is important that we gleaned as a result of our investigation that is important and will be included. And so figuring out ways to include that, as well as House Resolution 503 talks about the legislative suggestions and recommendations. Obviously, the Electoral Count Act reform is among the biggest and one that we already sent over, but there are others that will be included. So all of that will take time. Members are getting through it, digesting a lot of the information. Chairman Thompson has sent over hundreds of pages for us to read in the reading room. And so getting through that and having decision points ahead. So it's reading and then meeting to talk about that, making suggestions, edits, changes, getting consensus, and then likely going back and reading more and making sure that our edits and changes are reflected in the final documents. That's all it's about.
And when do you think we'll see that final document?
Soon, this month.
Congressman Pete Aguilar, a Democrat from California, a member of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol, at a news conference today with other members of the incoming House Democratic leadership for the next Congress. Congressman Aguilar is also going to be the caucus chair. Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, for the second time in as many weeks, opened his Tuesday news conference with an unsolicited comment relating to former president and now 2024 presidential candidate Donald Trump. Last week, it was about anti-Semitism, white supremacy related to some dinner guests that Donald Trump had. This week, it was in response to Donald Trump's social media post about the 2020 election and Twitter's content moderation that year. The post reading, "A massive fraud of this type and magnitude allows for the termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution." Here's Senator McConnell.
First, let me just say that anyone seeking the presidency who thinks that the Constitution could somehow be suspended or not followed, it seems to me, would have a very hard time being sworn in as president of the United States.
Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky opening up a news conference today. ABC News reporting that a Manhattan jury has found former President Donald Trump's namesake real estate company guilty of criminal tax fraud 3 weeks after he announced a third presidential run. The jury found the two entities of the Trump Organization guilty as charged on all counts, including scheme to defraud, conspiracy, criminal tax fraud, and falsifying business records. The entities are Trump Corporation and Trump Payroll Corporation, accused of paying the personal expenses of some executives without reporting them as income and for compensating them as independent contractors instead of full-time employees. ABC News says each entity was charged with scheme to fraud, conspiracy, criminal tax fraud, and falsifying business records. This is Washington Today. Back to Senator McConnell, he was also talking about the business before Congress this month, expecting, or at least hoping, to wrap up in the next couple of weeks, including funding the federal government. Temporary funding expires December 16th, and also passing the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA.
With regard to all the issues that are swirling around, let me just say that we're at a pretty significant impasse. I think job one is to try to get the NDAA approved without any extraneous matters included in it. We've done this for 60 straight years, and I don't think this ought to be the first year that we don't achieve passing an NDAA. With regard to government spending, time is ticking. We have not been able to agree on a top line yet, and I think it's becoming increasingly likely that we may need to do a short-term CR into early next year. We're running out of time, and that may end up being the only option left that we could agree to pursue.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell with reporters. That was part of his opening statement. And then other Senate Republican leaders spoke. Then Senator McConnell came back to answer questions. And those questions were about the government funding situation and the defense authorization bill. And also what happened at today's congressional gold medal ceremony.
Clarify what you're saying about a short-term CR here. I know you said earlier at the meeting in the White House you wanted to do an omnibus here. Kevin McCarthy indicated just the past couple of days that he prefers a short-term CR, so when the House is in control, you haven't changed your position here based on what McCarthy says. This is based on the reality of time or what?
Well, as I tried to say earlier, we're running out of time and we don't have agreements to do virtually anything, which would only leave us with the option of a short-term CR into early next year. So I'm dealing with the practical situation, which is, number one, as others have pointed out, they are, in my judgment, screwing up the NDAA by trying to drop a lot of unrelated things on it. And then on the omnibus, we don't even have an overall agreement on how much we're going to spend, and we're running out of time. That's the main point.
But nothing because of what McCarthy said.
We're running out of time. There's only so much you can do with the time that's left, which leaves you only potentially with the option of a short-term CR into early next year.
This is the second straight week you've come out to begin your press conference criticizing Donald Trump. Can you say categorically that you would not support him if you were the Republican nominee?
What I'm saying is it would be pretty hard to be sworn in to the presidency if you're not willing to uphold the Constitution. That's what I said, and I just said it again.
What about your personal support?
Senator McConnell, the family of Brian Sicknick chose not to shake your hand at today's ceremony, and they said it's because they're concerned you have not done enough to call out former President Trump's actions after January 6th and leading up to it.
I would respond by saying today we gave the gold medal to the heroes of January 6th. We admire and respect them. They laid their lives on the line, and that's why we gave a gold medal today to the heroes of January 6th.
Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell with reporters today on Capitol Hill. On that last issue, CNN writes the family of a fallen officer snubbed top congressional Republicans on Tuesday at the ceremony held to honor law enforcement who defended the U.S. Capitol during the January 6, 2021 insurrection. In a moment of apparent tension, the family of U.S. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, who suffered strokes and died of natural causes one day after responding to the January 6th insurrection, refused to shake hands with either House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy or Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. Gladys Sicknick, mother of Brian Sicknick, telling CNN, quote, "They're just two-faced. I'm just tired of them standing there and saying how wonderful the Capitol Police is, and then they turn around and go down to Mar-a-Lago and kiss his ring and come back and stand here and sit with it just hurts." That from CNN. Senator McConnell getting those questions about government funding negotiations and asked about House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy's position. And this is what Congressman McCarthy said on Fox News on Monday night.
"But this omnibus thing takes away your power for
exactly
10 months. You will have no effect on these critical issues. Zero.
We're 28 days away from Republicans having the gavel. We would be stronger in every negotiation. So any Republican that's out there trying to work with them is wrong.
So that
why wouldn't you
Mitch
wait
McConnell?
With the hand
Does
is
that
stronger?
Include McConnell?
Yes. Why would you want to work on anything if we have the gavel inside Congress?
You just
we
won
have
the
a stronger.
House.
Yes. Wait till we're in charge."
House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy on Fox News Channel Monday night. Politico writing that of an omnibus spending bill, it could top $1.7 trillion in line with President Joe Biden's budget request and include a swath of other policy provisions, such as a bipartisan update to presidential certification law crafted in response to the Capitol riot, as members look to pack in the priorities before the next Congress starts. And this also in the political article, at the moment, Democrats are asking for about $25 billion overall more than Republican lawmakers are willing to give. Republicans have deemed that money unnecessary, arguing that Democrats largely achieve their domestic funding goals through party-line climate, tax, health, and COVID aid bills. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, also at a separate news conference today, still hopeful for a deal on the spending bill.
Today, we'll be continuing negotiations to chart a path forward to fully fund the government for the next year in an omnibus and our military in the NDAA. This isn't an easy process, but it's important nonetheless for the well-being of our troops, for the preservation of our national security, for the tens of millions of Americans who look to the federal government for a wide range of basic services. Democrats and Republicans must work together to fully fund the federal government and pass an omnibus and an NDA quickly. On that, tomorrow we'll have an all-senators classified briefing on the latest developments in Ukraine. I'm confident senators will leave that briefing with a stronger understanding about how critical an omnibus is, not just to fund the government and keep our country moving and innovating, but to ensure we're providing our troops, our veterans, and our allies with what they need. Now, we have a lot of work ahead of us, and though there's a lot of negotiating going on around us, we're going to work doggedly until we come to an agreement. Leader McConnell and I have agreed to try and work together to make sure we get a year-long omnibus funding bill done. We hope it can be done this year, and each side is going to have to give in order to send an omnibus to the president's desk and avert a pointless, painful government shutdown.
Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, majority leader at a news conference. And one more note about that other bill they are working on, the Defense Authorization Act. This from an article at The Hill. Senate Republican Whip John Thune said that Democratic leaders have previously indicated they would add a provision ending the vaccine mandate to the defense bill, but now are asking Republicans to also agree to the marijuana banking and permitting reform legislation in return. Articles quote Senator Thune as saying, "I don't think we're going to get in the business of allowing them to hold us hostage after they already agreed to something." The final balance of power in the Senate will be known after today's runoff election in Georgia between incumbent Democrat Raphael Warnock and Republican challenger Herschel Walker. C-SPAN spoke with Michael Schnell, reporter with The Hill, about what it means if one or the other wins.
The implications of today's Senate race are really significant when it comes to how you can actually legislate in the Senate. So, of course, if Raphael Warnock does win his first full term today, that would give Democrats a 51-49 seat majority. And as I mentioned, that would have real significant implications. First off, if we talk about just the committee level, those committees will no longer be split evenly between Democrats and Republicans. But if Warnock wins, then Democrats will have a majority on the committees, which will mean that the Senate no longer has to use that power-sharing agreement that Schumer and McConnell had agreed to last year. So that would be significant because it could really speed up the committee process when it comes to President Biden's nominees, especially judicial nominees on that Senate Judiciary Committee. It would then be that the majority that Democrats would be able to easily vote their judicial nominees out from committee and send to the Senate floor for a full vote. Also, Democrats winning an extra seat and giving them that 51 seat majority would mean that no one senator can no longer derail legislative negotiations. And when I say that, you know, we think of people like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who have sometimes not voted with the entire Democratic caucus, and they've sort of thrown off some negotiations or plans that have been set between the Democratic leaders. By giving the extra vote would give Democrats some breathing room so that they don't have to negotiate directly with those two lawmakers and that they can afford to lose one vote. And then when it also comes to that, also we can talk about things like absences, especially sicknesses, as we're still coming out of COVID. By having that extra breathing room, not all 50 Democrats will have to be in Washington to cast a vote on every bill to make sure that it'll pass, but they have that breathing room just in case there are any unforeseen absences among the senators. So those are just a few reasons why, even though Democrats do hold the majority of the chamber in the as things currently stand, them gaining one more seat would have some significant impacts.
When it comes to day-to-day business of the Senate, if Herschel Walker or if Raphael Warnock does win, what does it do for things like the future of the filibuster and call and particularly the day-to-day things to get legislation passed, getting a certain amount of senators to get on board with that legislation?
Well, look, even if Warnock wins, Democrats will still be at only 51 votes. So that 60-vote filibuster is still there. It's still a real beast, and it will still be, you know, a significant challenge for Democrats to get enough Republicans on board. I guess technically then they would they could have votes to take away the filibuster, though both Manchin and Sinema have both said they are opposed to it, so that is unlikely. But then the other elephant in the room here, if we talk about Democrats increasing their majority in the Senate, is that the House will still be in Republican hands. So that'll make legislating increasingly difficult for Democrats, largely because if you know, Democrats are able to send a messaging bill from the Senate to the House, though unlikely because of the filibuster and because of the lack of votes to take away the filibuster, it would likely not move in the House because there is that GOP majority there. So while some procedural things will be different and certainly things like nominees will be easier in the Senate, actually passing legislation for Democrats will still be a large hurdle because this House will be in Republican hands.
Michael Schnell is a congressional reporter for The Hill, joining C-SPAN on Tuesday morning's Washington Journal program. Polls in Georgia close 7 p.m. Eastern. C-SPAN will be covering any victory or concession speeches from the candidates. Check our schedule for when they might air. The Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel has another challenger running against her. Harmeet Dhillon, former Donald Trump campaign attorney, announced her candidacy on Fox News Channel Monday night.
Well, Tucker, I'm going to announce tonight that actually I am going to run for RNC chair. And the reason is that, you know, to play off of a famous catchphrase, Republicans are tired of losing. And I think that we really need to radically reshape our leadership in order to win. And we can't keep running elections like we did in the 90s and the 2000s. And we really have to modernize to compete with the Democrats dollar for dollar in the ways they fundraise, the way they deliver their ballots to the ballot boxes. Our messaging needs to be fresh and positive and not just reactive to news cycles and what the Democrats are doing. And I think that the party needs to realize that the party has become a populist party. The base of the party demands populist messages that speak to them and not Chamber of Commerce messages, not neocon messages, not warmonger messages. And I'm afraid that the base of our party is not getting what it needs from our leadership. And so after three successive rounds of really disappointing results, Tucker, I'm a member of the RNC and no other member is stepping up to challenge leadership. And our current leadership has never been challenged for the chair job. And I think that challenge and competition is very good. And so I'm hoping to gain the support of grassroots Americans who do not like the direction of the party and its leadership. They need to contact the 168 members of the RNC in their states and territories and tell them that they too want change. And I think that change is popular among the base. I hear from thousands of Americans on a weekly basis about that. They want to see us fighting. Tucker, you know as well as anybody else that I'm a fighter.
Yes, and I you
fight
are.
Every waking hour of the day. And that's what we need right now. And so that's me. I'm offering to take a giant, you know, step back from my law firm and my nonprofit to do this. Yeah. It's a big sacrifice. But I think it's important for our country that I love so much as a first generation immigrant.
Harmeet Dhillon on Fox News Channel Monday night with Tucker Carlson. She is the second announced candidate running against the current RNC chair, Ronna McDaniel. The other is Mike Lindell, the CEO of MyPillow. Also considering a run is Congressman Lee Zeldin, who just lost a race for New York governor. Those 168 members of the Republican National Committee will be voting for a chair at the committee's annual winter meeting in January. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and also on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. President Biden in Phoenix, Arizona today, visiting a site of a new computer chip plant being built by Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company. White House says the facility will increase that company's investment there to $40 billion. President highlighting the bills he signed into law this year to provide over $50 billion to support computer chip production in the U.S. and another $200 billion for scientific research. But as he was leaving the White House Tuesday morning, a reporter asking him about another issue, immigration, since where he is going is about an hour away from the U.S.-Mexico border.
Mr. President, why go to a border state and not visit the border?
Because there's more important thing going on. They're going to invest billions of dollars in a new enterprise.
President Biden with reporters as he left the White House. Congressman Jeff Duncan, Republican from South Carolina, retweeting the president's remarks you just heard, adding, "There is a full-scale invasion at our southern border that has made every state a border state, with over 4 million illegal immigrants encountered since Joe Biden took office. This is a national security crisis of epic proportions, and the president simply does not care." Aboard Air Force One on the flight to Arizona, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre meeting with reporters, and this came up.
The president was asked as he was leaving the White House if he was going to go to the border. He said he had there were more important things going on. Can you clarify those remarks? Was he being dismissive?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I just laid out a couple moments ago, like when the president first walked into the administration, the first thing he did was put forth a comprehensive immigration reform legislation. So that showed his commitment to dealing with that issue. Look, the president was clear that his top priority is investing in the American economy and in American communities. And he's focused on out-competing China and bringing back American jobs from overseas. That's what you're going to see today. And so if anyone believes that the president shouldn't make that his top priority, they should say that out loud, right? I mean, you're going to see for yourselves. When we land in Phoenix, Arizona, the president's going to lay out why this trip to Arizona is so important, why CHIPS and Science Act is so important, and what it's going to do for the American people and the people in Arizona, creating good paying jobs. Since the president has been in office, more than 700,000 manufacturing jobs have been created here alone. So just to step back, just to talk a little bit about what the president has done at the border. The president has taken action to secure our border and build a fair, orderly, and humane immigration system. He secured more funding than all of his predecessors to support the men and women of the Department of Homeland Security. He's put forth a comprehensive, as I just mentioned, immigration reform proposal. He's brought 20 world leaders, as some of you traveled with us to LA, together to jointly manage the migration challenge impacting the entire Western Hemisphere. That came out of that trip, the summit that he had in LA not too long ago. He focused on real solutions, not political stunts. And if border security is such a top priority for Republicans officials, voting against record funding for the Department of Homeland Security is an odd way to show that. And that's what we have been trying to lay out, right? I mean, you have Republican officials who continuously do political stunt but do not put forward a solution. And so we're solution-oriented. We want to come to a place where we find answers, and they're not doing that.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre with reporters on Air Force One. Washington Post reports a handful of bipartisan senators are working to strike separate 11th-hour immigration deals before Republicans take control of the House in January and make the politically tricky agreements even harder to reach. One of the congressional reporters on that article is Liz Goodwin, who joins us now by phone. Thank you very much. Who's working on this and what may be part of it?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. So the main piece of legislation that people are immigration advocates got excited about this possibility was from Senator Tillis and Senator Sinema. So a Republican and a Democrat had released kind of a loose framework that would involve a pathway to citizenship for 2 million Dreamers in exchange for a huge amount of border security, about $25 billion at least, and kind of reforming the way the asylum process works, where migrants would have to be held in centers while their asylum cases go through on the border instead of being released internally and then being given a court date for sometimes months or years in the future, given how backlogged the judicial system is. So this started floating around, and because, you know, Kevin McCarthy on the probable next House Speaker, he said that he really doesn't support anything that would legalize immigrants in any way at this stage. So I think people are aware that once the gavel turns over to Republicans on the House side, there's just this kind of thing just becomes really hard. So there's a last minute push here on the Hill to get this done while Democrats still control both chambers. But as you know, there's all this end of year must pass legislation that's really facing, a lot of complications, just even without adding on anything as politically volatile as immigration. So there's not a ton of optimism that it will actually happen. But given how much this issue has been kind of politically toxic, it's notable that Republicans are even talking about it and that there is some movement.
How about the White House? Are they involved in any of these talks?
The White House is encouraging the talks from afar, but they are not directly involved.
You mentioned that the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, and the possible next speaker, says that he doesn't want to deal with any legalization of immigrants. What is expected to be their approach when they take the majority?
So House Republicans have talked a lot about the border, and one of their top priorities there is actually investigating the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. There's been threats to impeach him if he doesn't resign, and that's going to be a major focus of their kind of investigations side of things. There's also definitely a demand for more border security money, but Democrats are pretty adamant that that has to come attached. If it's going to be a really significant investment, it has to come attached with something to address the situation of immigrants who are here who don't have status. And Dreamers in particular have been a group that's, very sympathetic. It's people who came here when they were children. And they've been, this has been something Democrats have been pushing for decades now.
We're talking with Liz Goodwin from The Washington Post. Back to the senators, the bipartisan group trying to put something together. Are they working on things that have been floating around in the past, or are they putting anything new into this?
It's a little bit of a mix. It's most of the ideas have been floating around in other legislation, but this is the first time that something around the lines of this asylum reform has been attached to the number of 2 million Dreamers getting a path to citizenship. That's kind of new and significant. And I think given that a lot of Republicans and some Democrats are really upset about the idea of Title 42 not being in use after the end of this month, that kind of allows the federal government to expel a lot of migrants under public health grounds. With that going away, there's sort of a feeling of urgency that that could make the crisis worse at the border and something needs to be done to address it. So there's sort of more carrots in there for the pro-enforcement crowd than in the past. And then having the population of Dreamers that would get the path to citizenship be larger than the number of people who are on deferred action right now, the DACA program, I think that's kind of a carrot to the Democrat side. So it is a little bit of a novel deal.
Liz Goodwin is a congressional reporter with The Washington Post. Her story's at WashingtonPost.com and on Twitter at Liz C. Goodwin. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Liz Goodwin's article has this paragraph about some House floor action this week. The House will vote on two immigration bills that would phase out the per-country cap on employment-based immigrant visas and provide resident status for non-citizen veterans who may face the threat of deportation. She writes, neither are expected to be taken up by the Senate, given the limited schedule to pass non-appropriations-related bills before the end of the year. Today's debate was on that non-citizen veterans bill. It was led by Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, Democrat from California.
The trauma of war can have terrible effects on our veterans. Individuals suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder are far more likely to become entangled with the criminal justice system. When that happens, citizens are simply subjected to the criminal justice system. For example, they're arrested for drug possession, they might serve time in the county jail, and when they're released, they've paid their debt to society. But non-citizens who are in the same situation, people who fought for our country, might serve their jail time for drug possession, but then they also face immigration court, because a crime that might lead to relatively minor consequences for a U.S. citizen could lead to deportation of a non-citizen veteran. Now, non-citizen veteran service records are meant to be considered during removal proceedings, but such consideration rarely occurs. Consequently, veterans who earned the right to citizenship decades ago have been deported. H.R. 7946 corrects this problem by giving deported veterans the opportunity to apply for a second chance and obtain lawful permanent residency. Relief under this bill is discretionary, available only to those veterans whose return is in the public interest. Additionally, the bill creates a review process for service members in removal proceedings to ensure that their service records are taken into account by immigration judges.
Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, Democrat from California, on the House floor. Opposing this bill, Congressman Tom McClintock, Republican, also from California.
A non-citizen who joins the military promising to defend our country and instead commits crimes against the citizens of our country is subject to deportation, and rightly so. This bill adds a political advisory committee, handpicked by Mr. Mayorkas, that in effect can override our deportation laws, and it invites criminal offenders who've already been deported back into our country. And it presumes they're of good moral character despite their criminal offenses simply by producing a green card. This is astonishing. Let's be very clear that the vast majority of legal immigrants who enlist in our military do so because of patriotism toward our country, and they are exemplary citizens and exemplary members of our armed forces. In recognition of their service, we offer them special avenues for naturalization under the Immigration and Nationality Act. That is as it should be. About 3% of U.S. veterans today are foreign-born. Many have been have chosen to become U.S. citizens. But that's not what this bill is about. This bill is about the bad apples who've been ordered deported for breaking our laws.
Congressman Tom McClintock, Republican from California, ranking member on the Immigration and Citizenship Subcommittee in the House. You heard before from Democratic Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren. She chairs that subcommittee. The House passed this bill by a vote of 220 to 208. It was largely along party lines, a few Republicans joining the Democrats and voting yes. And another bill in the House this week would get rid of the legal immigrant work visa per country cap of 7%. Supporters say limiting green cards based on country of origin is unfair and inefficient. Many visas go unused, while countries with large numbers of immigrants have backlogs of approved applications when that country's cap is exceeded. On Wall Street today, the Dow down 350, NASDAQ down 225, S&P down 57. Now to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. This story from Reuters: a third Russian airfield was ablaze on Tuesday from a drone strike, a day after Ukraine demonstrated an apparent new ability to penetrate hundreds of kilometers deep into Russian airspace with attacks on two Russian airbases. Kyiv did not directly claim responsibility for the strikes, but nonetheless celebrated them. And Russia responded to Monday's attacks with what it called a massive strike on Ukraine's military control system, though it did not identify any specific military targets for what Ukraine called Moscow's latest strikes on civilian infrastructure. That reporting from Reuters. At today's State Department briefing in Washington, D.C., this question to the spokesperson, Ned Price.
I want to ask you about some of the strikes in recent days targeting Russian airfields, basically penetrating hundreds of kilometers deep into Russian airspace. What is the U.S. view on these strikes? I'm asking because the U.S. obviously provides a lot of weapon systems to Ukraine, and these were apparently drones, Soviet-made drones, but would Washington be comfortable with Ukraine using any of the weapons that it provided to hit targets well inside Russian territory?
Humaira, a couple things. First, I am not aware that anyone has officially claimed responsibility for the explosions that have taken place inside of Russia, apparently, over recent days. So I can't speak to what you're pointing to specifically, but I'll make a couple broader points. Since and even before the start of Russia's illegal, brazen invasion of Ukraine on February 24th of this year. The United States has provided our Ukrainian partners with precisely what they need to defend themselves, to defend their sovereignty, to defend their independence, to defend their territorial integrity. And the nature of that defensive security assistance has evolved over time. In the earliest days, it was to help Ukraine fortify itself for the forthcoming and then the what was at the time the present Battle of Kyiv. As Russia's brutal invasion went on and the nature and the location of the battle changed, we provided and we are providing Ukraine with precisely what it needs to take on that battle, to defend against Russian aggression in the east, in the north, in the Donbass, precisely where the battle has been more recently. Using this security assistance, the Ukrainians have demonstrated their effectiveness. They have demonstrated their grit, their determination to wrest back the territory that Russia has illegally seized from Ukrainian authorities. We are providing Ukraine with precisely what it needs to achieve those goals.
But what about inside Russian territory?
We have not provided Ukraine with weapons that it is to use inside of Russia. We've been very clear that these are defensive supplies. The president said very clearly some time ago, we are not enabling Ukraine to strike beyond its borders. We are not encouraging Ukraine to strike beyond its borders. Everything we are doing, everything the world is doing to support Ukraine is in support of Ukraine's independence, its sovereignty, its territorial integrity.
State Department spokesperson Ned Price at today's briefing. The International Energy Agency reporting today that Russia's invasion of Ukraine has accelerated the transition to clean energy, and that by 2025, renewables will surpass coal as a source of global electricity generation. Expected growth in renewable energy now 30% above what the International Energy Agency was projecting just 1 year ago. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter Word for Word to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. You can subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.